their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good afternoon to everyone. The court will hear case number 05-2610, Michael Lambert against Cecil Davis. Mr. Friedman.
May it please the court. The petitioner here brings two questions before the court. One concerns whether successor gatekeeping provisions of the Anti-Terrorist Effective Death Penalty Act, called APA for short, bar jurisdiction in the district court. The second question is whether the Indiana Supreme Court arbitrarily denied the petitioner's relief in the violation of due process because it did not apply the Saylor opinion to him retroactively. First, the petition submits that the district court should have jurisdiction to rule on the habeas petition. This court should have treated it as a first-time habeas petition.
Mr. Friedman, may I suggest that you might want to raise your voice a little bit.
Okay.
The amplification's not all that good, and you're competing with this GSA fan over your head.
Okay. The gatekeeping provisions of APA should not bar the filing. The historical importance of the habeas has encouraged the United States Supreme Court to liberally interpret APA in favor of defendants in determining whether there should be a jurisdictional bar against defendants bringing claims in the district court. The two factors that the Supreme Court has used in garnering their opinions is that whether the defendant ever had an opportunity to bring a non-abusive claim. The second is whether the statutory language specifically and unambiguously barred such type of claim. Because basically these opinions indicate that repealing habeas remedy by implication is not favored. To repeal habeas jurisdiction, Congress must articulate and specifically and unambiguously statutory directives to effect a repeal. I mean, for example, I'll go through the Slack case, which held that an individual could appeal an unexhausted claim as a first-time habeas that was not ruled on the merits the first time. The same is also in Venus Martell-Orell. In that case, the individual had a particular claim brought in a first-time habeas. He was dismissed as an unexhausted claim, not ruled on the merits. He was allowed to bring that claim back into court as if it was a first-time habeas petition, all on the basis that the act itself did not specifically bar that type of proceedings. It would have been too harsh, and it should not be allowed unless the statute specifically said so, and they interpreted that so. They also said the same thing in Slack, the same case that I mentioned. They used the same principle to let them bring a certificate of appealability on the actual merits of the claim, even though the district court procedurally defaulted the claim. And the rules on COA specifically seem to imply that you could not do so unless there was a substantial constitutional question in the COA. But the Supreme Court once again interpreted the act liberally enough to allow a petitioner to rule both on the procedural question and the constitutional question because it wasn't clear enough. Also, in Felker, the first case interpreting APA, they said where the act actually did not indicated that on a successor provisions that were denied by the Court of Appeals, there could be no cert jurisdiction. They said, once again, the Supreme Court had original jurisdiction under original habeas, even though the act didn't seem to indicate otherwise because it did not specifically bar such relief. Governing, using those principles today, the same result should be in the situation here. And not allowing this to be a first-time petition, not allowing it to be a successor petition, and to be treated as a first-time petition. The successor provisions itself, in APA itself, 2244B2, have two provisions. You are allowed to bring a petition in the district court only after getting approval by the Court of Appeals if you meet one or two criteria. whether the person was innocent, and can prove evidence of clear and convincing evidence concerning his innocence. And the second one is whether there was a new Supreme Court decision by the indicating that it would be retroactive. We submit that the statute does not specifically bar the scenario that's in this particular case. In fact, it's a third criteria. The criteria is this: that we have an unabusive claim that could not have been brought previously. And in fact, it occurred.
Why couldn't it have been brought previously?
Because it was based on the.
It was based on a 2002 amendments.
That's correct.
The law in Indiana.
And that took that was passed before the habeas bill, and the bill itself, the act, the 202 amendment, said it would be applied prospectively. So the defendant would have no basis to claim any benefit from that. And what happened here was that the Indiana Supreme Court, in the Saylor opinion, indicated that it would be applied retroactively.
So to grant you relief, we would have to say that the Indiana Supreme Court incorrectly construed Indiana law.
I don't think it's a matter of state law. But what they did was, and obviously I think that's an important question in the case, what they did was, they interpreted policy, and the policy that they interpreted was that nobody would be put to death without a jury recommendation.
Did they actually articulate that policy?
I believe so. The wording, I mean, if I may read just from the two sentences from the opinion, they've indicated by the virtue of the 2002 amendments to the death penalty statute, no future executions would take place without a jury recommendation.
This is in Saylor.
That's correct. Under these circumstances, it's inappropriate to carry out a death sentence that could not be imposed today.
Well, but in that case, the jury recommended against the death penalty, and the judge imposed it notwithstanding the recommendation.
That's correct. But in the case...
That's the circumstances of that case. That's certainly not this case.
No, it's not identical circumstances. But what we have before this court is an undisputed and invalid jury recommendation. Could you equate a recommendation that's invalid? And that's undisputed. This court, the Indiana Supreme Court, found that it was invalid, found it to be harmless error, and this court ultimately wrote an opinion indicating that jury recommendation was invalid.
Ironically, it wouldn't be invalid today, though, would it?
Yes, it would.
Why?
Why? Because they found that it was harmful.
No, but the basis for the finding that it was harmful was the improper admission of the victim impact testimony, wasn't it?
That's correct, and that would still be violated today. The nature of that victim impact.
Why?
Because of the but twofold. One, under the Indiana law, they found it to be invalid, and two, Payne versus Tennessee would still cover the degree of that type of that type of victim impact.
And they also, if I remember, decided that Saylor would not apply to a hung jury situation.
That's correct.
What's your position on that? Why is?
Well,
your case less or more principled, or what?
That's a really an interesting question, but I think not. I think Holmes is not as strong. First of all, is not as strong as the case. He does not have an invalid jury recommendation. He has to have a tainted jury recommendation.
He has none.
But the unusual posture is that under the old statute and under the new statute, the hung jury process remained the same.
I guess my problem with your point is this. If your case were the only outlier, the only non-Saylor case existing in Indiana, there'd always be the suspicion that the Supreme Court of Indiana had been arbitrary and capricious in segregating out your client from everyone else. But here we have the Indiana Supreme Court having made several distinctions of when Saylor ought not to apply. Whether they be right or wrong, can we say that they are arbitrary and capricious, that they violate a federal right?
I believe you can. I mean, I think that Lampert's case is unique. It does stand out. And once again, Holmes, I mean, it's an unusual posture when they have a system that provides for what happens when you have no jury recommendation, the judge decides. And so that initial circumstance hasn't changed between the old statute and the new statute. Here, we have an undisputed invalid jury recommendation, which is tainted, and which the Indiana Supreme Court started with the proposition that it didn't matter because he could have gotten the death penalty. But under those premises, that would be inconsistent with Hicks versus Oklahoma, because Hicks versus Oklahoma says once you create the process that ultimately requires that the jury is involved in the sentencing process, it must be done according to due process, and you should not be allowed to have an invalid jury recommendation. And in fact, I think it's interesting that the judge that dissented at the time, Justice Rehnquist, dissented believing that, well, Hicks had a jury recommendation, and that it wasn't. They were talking about merely an invalid jury recommendation, and that wouldn't lead to a constitutional challenge. But the majority went the other way in that case. So I think the fact is, you have a tainted jury recommendation, which the trial judge relied upon in deciding the sentence of death. And this particular court, the first time we were before the court, the court decided that didn't make any difference because at that time, Indiana system, the judge made the final determination. And if he made the final determination, the error of the invalid jury recommendation was not enough to rise to a level of due process. Once the jury recommendation has a higher effect, we think that we're within the position of Hicks versus Oklahoma. Going back to the statute, I want to make one important point, is that we believe that the position that we're taking, that this is a third criteria that's not even covered by the exception, because it's not talking about innocence, we're not talking about a new case from the Supreme Court, we're talking about existing authority where the factual pattern, the claim occurred by the state itself putting it into play, deciding a successor petition violation of due process and couldn't be brought. But that type of factual scenario that limits it's so limited and does not fly in the face of the statute. The statute, it would never anticipated that type of situation. We also indicate whether the strength of the error or not, we would still be entitled to a new sentencing hearing. But we indicate to you that there's a high likelihood if there was a retrial here, a resentencing hearing, there's a reasonable probability that he would not get the death sentence. We submitted statistics that we gathered that's in Appendix H, indicating that we know there's at least 14 individuals that had unfortunately shot and killed a police officer and didn't get the death penalty. And here we believe, 7 people on the road that had or were on the road who had shot and killed a cop and got the death penalty. So in that, Under that scenario, we think that this error that tainted the victim impact, when you bring it untaintedly, ultimately you would have a fair hearing. I would like to just conclude and say, that the 2002 amendment may have come too late for some defendants, but it's better to arrive late than not at all. And to say that. Also, what I'd like to say in finding that is that if this court did find that the district court had jurisdiction, We recommend the court to just remand it back to the district court because they had jurisdiction. It should have its say and should decide this. And this court has done that in the cases that we cited in the brief. If there's a culpable claim, and we submit it's a culpable claim because this court did give us a stay of execution for the petitioner and did grant the COA.
So it would go back to the district court. The district court would have the first, should take the first crack at the merits of the case.
That's correct. That's correct. And if we're correct on the jurisdiction, we think we are. We think that this is a narrower circumstance. Even in Ray Page, we think this is so narrow. This is the second time something like this has come back to the court. You really, what you really need to have to get through this exception, to avoid the gatekeeping, is really some retroactive effect that's occurring by the high state courts itself, which could not, the claim could not have been brought. If this court has any questions, we'll save the rest of the time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Friedman. We'll hear now from Mr. Creason.
Thank you, Judge Ripple. May it please the court. No circuit has adopted the rule the petitioner urges this court to use today. This court's decision in In re Page clearly controls the outcome of this case and should be followed to find, as the district court found, the petition, the second habeas petition of Michael Lambert to be successive as it cannot meet the gateway requirements in 2244B. Because petitioner's first habeas petition was adjudicated on the merits, and this petition once again challenges the validity of his convictions and or his sentence, 2254 applies and bars the petition in this case.
What do you do with the, I'm sorry, no. What do you do with the argument your opponent makes in his brief that we really need to read Page in light of the subsequent Supreme Court cases that indicate that second or successive is really a term of art in the statute that incorporates, by reference, the concept of abusive writ. If you recall, in Page, this court took precisely the opposite view. And isn't there a question as to whether or not the rationale of Page, therefore, does, in fact, endure after the recent Supreme Court cases?
Respectfully, of course, this court should always review its precedents in light of subsequent Supreme Court decisions. However, Slack and Martinez-Villarreal don't have any application in this case. What Slack and Martinez-Villarreal both stand for is that it's not your petition is not a second or successive petition if your first one was never adjudicated on the merits. That is what second or successive, the meaning is. If your first petition was adjudicated on the merits, then your second petition is a successive second or successive habeas petition. So although there is the statement in In re Page that the doctrine of abuse of the writ is defunct, that can be read actually to be entirely consistent with Slack and Martinez-Villarreal in the sense that 2244B only applies in a second or successive habeas petition, which is in fact the exact language, and that the definition of second or successive is a term of art. So here we do not have a successive petition, or we do have a successive petition because the first petition was adjudicated on the merits. In fact, it's even more of a merits decision than if it were barred by procedural default or under a time bar grounds, or something else.
Mr. Creason, if I could ask one other question along these lines. You said that no other circuit had taken the position urged by the petitioner in this case, but then again, has any other circuit actually been confronted with this precise issue that we have before us today?
Yes, but it's but in a somewhat different procedural posture, if I could explain.
Please.
All of the cases cited, as I discuss in the state's, as the state discusses in its brief, all of the cases, its reply brief, all of the cases cited by petitioner with regards to the abuse of the writ rule Actually, most of them discuss, and all of them are consistent with this principle, that...
Those are all parole and...
Well, that's right. That if your second petition does not challenge the merits, or excuse me, the fact or validity of your convictions or sentence, that also is not a second or successive petition. And we look to abuse of the writ doctrine to determine whether or not it could have been raised, whether or not it was really about the same thing. That's entirely consistent with what the rule the state urges now and what we believe N. Ray Page holds. In fact, this court has never ruled a second or successive petition on a prison disciplinary case or a parole revocation case. We have them all the time. If so, the state would be vigorously arguing a second or successive bar. What those cases do talk about, though, is in precisely that distinction, that whenever you're trying to get another bite at the apple as to your validity of your conviction or sentence, 2244B applies. There's no way around it. While petitioner would like the court to say that, well, the language of 2244B does not specifically say that in this type of circumstance it's barred, 2244B says the opposite. It says only if it meets these requirements does it get through. And the first requirement is that it be a second or successive petition, which, under the definition, every court in the land has ruled.
But you're urging us there to take a very literal view of second or successive. And don't the later Supreme Court cases counsel against doing that?
Respectfully, Honor, the state's urging that, in fact, the court use exactly the doctrines that the Supreme Court's teaching and all the other circuits use, which is to look at what is the meaning of a second or successive petition and apply it here. And under that definition, this petition is a second or successive petition. The facts that gave rise to the claim at issue in this case arose before the adjudication of Lambert's first petition. Lambert's petition was not dismissed until near the end of 2002, and yet the 2002 amendments to the Indiana Death Penalty Statute were passed before and effective on July 1st of 2002. In fact, the state post-conviction petitioner in the Benny Lee Saylor case immediately seized upon the change in the rule and says, because I couldn't receive a sentence now under the current procedure, it would be unjust to execute me under a procedure that is now defunct. That, in fact, he was essentially arguing some sort of ameliorative type argument. What the Indiana Supreme Court eventually said was, we don't need to get into retroactivity or amelioration. Instead, we're going to use our own powers under the Indiana Constitution to review and revise sentences as they alone see fit. It's just like a sentencing court. The Indiana Supreme Court has the power to change a sentence. That's exactly what it
is. As a point of clarification, at the time of the passage of the 2002 amendments, where was this case precisely?
It was pending for decision before the district court. The petition could have been amended.
On federal habeas.
That's correct. I believe, and this is off the top of my head, I believe that the first habeas petition, Judge McKinney dismissed in October of 2002. I'm not sure the precise date. And the reason why this is important, the stay and obey procedure for an unexhausted habeas claim was well settled in this court. Long before the decision by the state legislature to change, or the Saylor decision, or even petitioner doing anything in his habeas petition. And what petitioner could have done if he wanted to raise this claim was to tell the district court, there's been a change of Indiana law that I think I'm entitled to relief under, and I would like an opportunity to exhaust that claim, move for a stay. Under this court's precedence, the stay would have had to have been granted. And he would have gone to state court, filed a successive post-conviction request. The Indiana Supreme Court would have ruled upon it. He would have then come back to the district court, filed a motion to amend his habeas petition. It would have had to have been allowed to be amended, and we would have had the discussion in the first habeas proceeding. It was available to him. He chose not to do it and instead pursue a very similar argument before this court as to his sentence, which is just that it was wrong to do appellate reweighing and a harmless error analysis. essentially, we're talking about the same sort of circumstance here. He was complaining that because he didn't have a jury recommendation, and because the jury recommendation was struck and the entire sentencing tainted, that this court should grant habeas relief. It's a slightly different theory asserted now, but it was available then, and he chose to use a different theory. Under any analysis, under Section 2244, that is a successive habeas petition. There is no authority cited by petitioner that would suggest otherwise. If I could, turning to, unless Your Honors have something, more questions on the 2244 analysis.
If I may.
Please.
We've talked about the technical ins and outs of the statute for the last few minutes, Mr. Creese. Let's put that aside for a minute. You would agree, I suppose, that this is not the typical situation to which the successive petition provision addresses itself. The usual situation is when a petitioner has gone through his appellate direct appeal, and after he finishes his direct appeal, he takes his collateral attacks in the state courts and then takes his federal habeas and then says, I'd like to bring another federal habeas about something that happened during the investigation of the crime, during the trial of the crime, something of that nature. And we say, no dice, one bite at the apple. And that seems to be the thrust of what Congress was worried about. We have that intervening circumstance here, though, of a later judgment by a state Supreme Court in which it had arguably similarly, although maybe not identically, situated people before it, and it said, we're going to give some people relief and we're not going to give other people relief. And the question is whether the Supreme Court of the state acted arbitrarily when it did that. Shouldn't the focus be that second judgment and the constitutional implications of the state action at that point? Was that really what Congress was trying to avoid in this successive petition issue?
The state believes so, and we believe that the history supports that. What Congress was interested in was curbing the ongoing availability of federal habeas and the routine, in many courts, what was a routine stay of execution and ongoing habeas proceedings for the second, third, fourth, even many more times than that. And that's what we have here. While perhaps this is a somewhat different take on that same story, it's not irrelevant enough take, if you will. Benefield v. Davis that was decided earlier this year, which reaffirmed the holding in Page, along with other holdings, was another Indiana death penalty case pending just before execution, where he sought to allege that there had been a change in the law, and that really allowed him, intervening change in the law, and that allowed him to go back and have another bite at the habeas apple. That is essentially what we're dealing with here.
Is this a change in the law, or is this a disparate treatment situation with respect to the law?
What Lambert is arguing is that the law has changed and that he should have the benefit of that, and the Indiana Supreme Court has denied him the benefit of the change in the law.
While
that is really what he's arguing. I'm sorry?
While granting it to others.
To which the rule applies. In fact, it's not even a rule. And perhaps I can discuss this some more. The Indiana Supreme Court has the authority under the Indiana Constitution to review and revise sentences. The Indiana Supreme Court has set a standard for that in its appellate rules. That is, whether or not the sentence is appropriate in light of the character of the offender and the nature and circumstances of the offense. In the Saylor case, and in two other death penalty cases out of Indiana, the Christopher Peterson case and the William Minnick case, all were jury overrides, the colloquial term for a judge overriding a jury recommendation against death. And in those cases, the Indiana Supreme Court said that because you could receive a sentence of death then, when you had your sentence under this procedure, but it is impossible to do so now and for the foreseeable future, it is inappropriate That is, under the Indiana Supreme Court's authority to review and revise sentences, it was inappropriate to execute someone who could no longer be sentenced to death under the same statute. That was the quote-unquote rule of Saylor v. Snain. That is what was explained by the Indiana Supreme Court in Holmes and again in Lambert. Lambert now wants to recharacterize that and saying that he really made the 2002 statutes retroactive. Nowhere, and in no fair reading of Lambert, Holmes, or Saylor, can that be gleaned. The Indiana Supreme Court was using its own authority as individual judges deciding whether or not a death sentence is appropriate, a proportionality type review, and deciding that we don't want death sentences in this sort of case. Every time the Indiana Supreme Court does that, and they do it in every single case that they review, every time they were to reverse a sentence, someone who could come and say, you know, I'm pretty close to him, my nature and circumstances of my crime are similar, my character is similar, the circumstances of my procedural case are similar enough, and the Indiana Supreme Court has to say, no, that's really not the type of case that we were talking about. Or, as in the Peterson and Minnick cases, this is exactly what we were talking about. And you two fall into this category that we think is inappropriate to execute. That's what has occurred here. So there is no state rule. There is no ruling of state law here. It is merely the Indiana Supreme Court deciding on its own whether or not someone deserves the death penalty. That is not what Lambert characterizes this case now. And it's certainly not the sort of thing that can be that is applicable under Hicks, which Hicks said, there's a rule, you just don't get it because we don't want to give it to you.
Suppose the Indiana Supreme Court had used an obviously impermissible basis for distinguishing those individuals to whom this state procedural rule would apply, and they would have the benefit of Ring, and those to whom it would not. Let's say it was on the basis of what county the case was tried in, for instance, okay? Or on the basis of race or religion or something of that nature. Would a distinction along those lines be cognizable in habeas?
Perhaps.
How?
What Hicks says is that in Hicks, there was the confusion over at the trial court level. He said you didn't get a jury trial on essentially a habitual offender type enhancement, and the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals said, "Well, we're not going to give you the benefit of that now because that issue was decided, and you know you didn't get it then. We're not going to give it to you now." In other words, you're entitled to it, but you don't get it because of the timing of your case. Not a retroactivity thing. It was just arbitrarily, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, due process requires everybody be treated that way. If we did it on the basis that Lake County defendants and Gary were treated differently, this appropriateness review applied here in Lake County, but not in Marion County in Indianapolis, that would seem to me to be awfully close to the line drawn in Hicks and would appear to the state to be troublesome holding.
Would that get you past the statute, the successive appeal statute?
Oh, I'm not sure that it would get you. No, I don't believe it would get you, however, a second bite at habeas. I'm just saying you may have a federal due process claim.
Oh, yeah, fine. But no.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood
you. Suppose the Supreme Court of Indiana had said that we are going to give we're going to apply Ring retroactively as a matter of state law to every person convicted of a capital crime who is Buddhist, but not to everybody who is Protestant.
Right.
Okay. Could we touch that? Would a man go to his death on the basis of that ruling in a federal court not be able to touch it because of the successive appeal statute?
While I believe that to be an unjust result, yes. And the reason is because Congress decides who and under what circumstances habeas is available.
Well, see, that we go back to my original problem. Is that what Congress really meant
if
when it passed that statute?
Congress Congress drafted the statute in clear and unambiguous language. If it had intended for a circumstance such as that to be permitted, it would have labeled it in one of the exceptions to the second or successive rule. For instance, the retroactivity, a claim unavailable, something like that. And in fact, it may in fact pass. I don't have a copy of the statute in front of me. There may be room under one of the exceptions. I believe one of the exceptions to 2244B is that a claim previously unavailable couldn't be discovered with due diligence. And perhaps a sort of bias or discrimination on that sort may actually get you in. Now I'm being somewhat creative, and so I don't know, and I haven't researched that particular topic, so I'm hesitant to answer it.
Sure, I understand.
However, Congress decides all the time whether or not someone has a cause of action and under what circumstances, and unjust results do occur. And respectfully, the court lacks the jurisdiction under, it would appear, unless it would fall under an exception to 2244B, it would appear that would be the case. It certainly perhaps would not be a desirable consequence, but it's a consequence that Congress has caused. And absent some other rule, I don't see how we get around it. However, that isn't what we're dealing with in this case. In this case, he doesn't even have a federal claim. He doesn't even, essentially, he's saying the Indiana Supreme Court should have decided state law differently, as Judge Evans pointed out. And that's really what we're dealing with here. And the court doesn't have to reach the question as to whether or not 2244B would always bar a case such as Judge Ripple, you suggested. There may be an exception that could be carved out for such obvious violations of due process. But here, this doesn't even approach it, respectfully. In re Page and all the cases afterwards are consistent in that, in all the circuits, that this case is a second or successive habeas petition. As this court is bound by its decisions, In re Page and Benneville v. Davis control the outcome of this case. The state respectfully requests that it affirm the judgment of the district court, or in the alternative, if it finds jurisdiction, find that no federal claim has been presented or no habeas relief is justified under 2254 on the merits of the claim.
Thank you, Mr. Creason. You have 10 minutes, Mr. Friedman.
A couple of points. First, I want to, in reviewing the papers, Judge Evans, you asked about whether Payne would apply. Payne, in the Indiana Supreme Court, resolved the victim impact problem with Payne versus Tennessee and found it to be harmful error. I just wanted to bring that out. I want to cover a couple of points that they went through. They indicated that we could have brought this claim earlier. I think that's out of the realm. I mean,
hold on in federal court. I want to go back to state court because we have a new law.
We couldn't convince the federal judiciary, and nobody did, that Ring was going to be applied retroactively. How are we going to obtain a stay of abeyance on a claim that the state statute should be applied retroactively when the face of the statute said it should be applied prospectively? I mean, I don't think we could have convinced anybody of it until the Saylor case came down. And the Saylor case came down on May 24th, 2004. After the district court had already ruled. And we were in the late stages of the appeal
It hadn't been applied retroactively by the Supreme Court, and the state statute was prospective in nature as far as you knew.
Right.
It wasn't until Saylor that you...
That's correct.
...that you had any indication that this had a possibility of being retroactive. I see. Thank you.
That was while this case was pending?
I believe, well, I have. Yes, because the initial brief was filed in April of 03.
So it was still viable after Saber.
And it was argued 2 years ago. It was argued in October of 2003. I'm sorry, I don't like what the date of the initial judgment was out of the Seventh Circuit, but it was way. And was decided on April 7th, 2004. So this court had already decided its decision before Saylor had even come down. So I don't believe that we would have any in good faith brought any claim. I mean, of course, we could have done anything we wanted to do, but it wouldn't have been a legitimate right claim at all. We're not at all like in the same level as Benefield. That was a 60B issue trying to bring a same claim based on a new Supreme Court decision. And those issues have long passed any opportunity for petitioners. So that's totally different. And I disagree with my learned counsel. I mean, the Supreme Court decisions have interpreted APA to avoid harshness, have avoided scenarios that are just not in the statute, that give some indication that they are in the statute, but make no logical sense. Like the example that you have to have a substantial constitutional claim to get a COA, and then the district court procedurally defaults you. That on its face would imply that you couldn't take an appeal to the Court of Appeals. But Slack interpreted that you can both appeal the procedural default and the constitutional claim. And then the same thing with Felker. They say no review of any Court of Appeals claims that deny a successor to be filed back in the district court. Well, you take it as original habeas in the United States Supreme Court, which has the same effect as the cert petition. So the Supreme Court has done its job, realizing that habeas is pretty important and that Congress has to be absolutely clear before these remedies are taken away. There's no due diligence exception that the state is arguing about. That relates to the innocent section. And I can say clearly we're not raising any innocent claims here. And so the key is whether the harshness of it. And I think one final point that I wish to make is that what are the Hicks versus Oklahoma opinions about? And they're about that once the state provides criminal punishment in the discretion of the trial jury, that it's not correct to say that the defendant's interest in the exercise of that discretion is merely a question of state law. And they say that specifically in the opinion itself. Some aspects of sentencing practices created by the state are so fundamental that the state must adhere to them before they impose a valid sentence. And we cite numerous cases that use the Hicks analysis, and they're vast. Not only in this type of scenario, we've cited them in jury. When the jury in the death penalty case gets the wrong jury instruction as to the question of how to weigh mitigation, aggravation, they found that to be a Hicks violation. This court in a Batson claim, when the trial court was following an unusual policy that was outside the scope of Batson, they were requiring the state and the defendants coming in with the reasons why they were excluding blacks. They said you shouldn't do that until somebody objects. They found that to be a Hicks versus Oklahoma violation. And there's some similarity in that case because ultimately the Indiana Supreme Court created a rule prospectively saying you shouldn't be doing that, handle Batson hearings in that fashion. And this court in the Aki Akeem case came out and said that violates Hicks versus Oklahoma. Cases are cited in the brief. I just would want to close that this is an unusual circumstance. I don't know how many other scenarios after Page that this has come before the court. I don't think it's a lot. You have to have that intervening factor from the state court to have this question, as Judge Ripple has indicated. And I think it would be horrible that an isolated incident, that this probably will not occur again. This case is probably a fossil, as this court said, but he shouldn't be executed because it's a fossil, that this type of question. It's questionable if there will be any reweighing again. The Supreme Court of Indiana ultimately has decided a couple of cases concerning the new statute, and they didn't reweigh. They didn't look for harmless error. They simply gave him a new sentencing hearing. The Stroud case is cited in there, and the other case is Bostwick, and it's cited in the Holmes case. I would add that we distinguish Holmes because of the issue between the it still applies in the statute, but candidly, Holmes has been treated unfairly too, and I think they got the problem here because they executed somebody with a hung jury. And they're uncomfortable. And there's just a handful of people. There's two people out there. They're different factual scenarios. And frankly, they shouldn't be put to death. It would be unfair without a new sentencing hearing. If there's any other questions,
I believe not, Mr. Friedman. Thank you. Court would like to express its deep thanks both to Mr. Friedman and to Mr. Creason for their fine briefs and oral argument. This is a very difficult case, and we do appreciate your help very much. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will rise.